Well, hey, Ethan, man, I really appreciate this opportunity to get to sit here and talk to you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. And so I've stumbled on your Instagram and I love your handle because it's Hello a Forest. But then at the same time, you've also actually written a book with the same title. So I'm really curious what really inspired you or maybe kind of, what inspired you to kind of write that book?
So I'm, for those of you who don't know me, so I'm a forester mostly. And then now also an author and a content creator, which have sort of just come out of that. And the reason was that working as a forester, of course, there's all different kinds of foresters. And I think we would define what our job is in really different ways. But I define my job as it's my job to care for forested ecosystems. And within that, it's one thing to sort of think about, we think about nature and we have all these ideas we've built up around this concept of nature. And a lot of people, I think, believe that nature is this magical thing where if we just leave it alone, it'll be fine. And I think people are responding to the fact that humans on this continent over the last couple hundred years have not done a very good job of managing ecosystems and caring for ecosystems and have caused all of these problems that we now experience with them. And it makes sense that you would think that you'd want to leave them alone. But when you actually study forestry and you enter into this sort of deep relationship with these ecosystems, what you see is that in many cases, they need a lot of help. And they're dealing with this incredible volume of threats and stressors, from non-native invasive plants, animals, insects, pests, and pathogens, climate change, and all these things related to that, deforestation, forest fragmentation, pollution, the impact of historical land use, which has caused all of these really pervasive problems and deficiencies in our forests, deer overpopulation, all this stuff. And we call those things together global change. And so you enter into these ecosystems and you learn about them and you realize that actually, they're not okay. And that actually, not only do we rely on these ecosystems for our lives and for our quality of life, we rely on them ecologically and economically and culturally, and we need them. And also, in this moment, in many cases, they need us. So I, as a forester, and I think this is true probably for all foresters, we are imbued with this idea that we do not have to be bystanders in these ecosystems, that we can go into them and see what's going on, and then we can do something about it. And we have all these tools, and one of the most powerful of those tools is actually cutting a tree, which you could see as something that is exploitative and extractive, and it can be. But in a different way, what I really see it as is mobilizing this profound and beautiful process of tree mortality, which, by the way, is as normal and as natural, as ancient, and arguably as essential as the life of trees, and using it to affect positive changes in these ecosystems and to help them build things like resilience in a changing climate and to help them become more like the old growth forests that were cleared from our landscape centuries ago, and to help create habitats for species of concern and to do things like that. So I was in these ecosystems and being like, oh man, they need a lot of help. And then realizing that we have all these tools to help them and realizing how frequently those tools are kind of like misunderstood and how frequently people are just sort of this idea that the way that we love forests and the way that we take care of them must be just to do nothing. And seeing that that wasn't going to be the case. So with How to Love a Forest, it's a book which is really a land ethic book. It's about our reimagining our relationship to ecosystems and, following me along in this journey on my own land, which I call Bear Island, which is like when I got there was the most degraded forest I'd ever seen. And really exploring this idea of how some of these bittersweet and counterintuitive actions, like even cutting a tree, could be these profound expressions of compassion for ecosystems.
It's
So it's like you're finding this balance and then like helping the forest rewrite itself as like something were going wrong, and then kind of like maintaining a homeostasis like you would find in the human body.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, I think that one of the things that people don't understand about ecosystems, right, is like how we walk into a forest and we're like, oh, there's trees here and it's beautiful and it feels peaceful and it must be, you know, a place of perfect balance. You know, we often think of them as these like utopian societies, and it must be just this perfect thing. But actually, like these forests themselves, the way that they are, the attributes that they have, they have been tremendously disrupted, and that in many cases, like they are actually not functioning as they have for thousands of years. And so, yes, we're sort of like, I think about, you know, that what you mentioned, sort of homeostasis. I think about it as actually using the tools at our disposal, you know, not to make forests into this human-centric thing, but to help them be themselves and to help them rediscover these natural processes and these attributes, which are actually defining characteristics of what they are.
Can you elaborate on it? That's like very interesting perspective of like teach them to be what they need to be.
Yeah. And so, you know, where you are, we're in two different places. I'm up here in Vermont, and here, and in most of New England, we can say with confidence for most people that every forest they've ever been in New England was cleared in the 1800s, most of it for agriculture. There was this incredibly pervasive land clearing. And the forests that were cleared at that time, you know, and the landscapes that were cleared, our landscapes are probably 90-95% forested. We also had a lot of beaver activity. We think we had like 300 beaver dams per square mile in our valleys, which is incredible. And, you know, all those forests were cleared, many of them maintained as agricultural land or repeatedly clear cut for the following 100 to 150 years. The beavers were trapped out in the 1600s, then later reintroduced in the 1900s. We lost all of our species of large ungulates. So we think that moose and caribou and a now extinct species of elk called the eastern elk were our main large herbivores on our landscape. And they were hunted by our two apex predators, the eastern cougar, which here in Vermont we call the catamount, and wolves. And all of those things went away. And so, and now we have these forests on our landscape where the main large ungulate is white-tailed deer, which probably wasn't even here 300 years ago. We don't have those apex predators. We have forests that are like 60 to 100 years old in many cases and haven't had time to develop any of the defining characteristics that we would now use to describe an old growth forest, which was what forests were on this landscape for thousands of years. And the conditions that we find in those old growth forests are the conditions that all of our native biodiversity is adapted to. So like when we say, if I were to describe to you what like a typical old growth forest is in Vermont. And, you know, granted, they are also incredibly complex and irregular, defined actually by their irregularity and their variability. But in general, they have these qualities. They have big old trees, but not a lot, like 10 to 12 really big old trees per acre. They are equally defined by what we call in the ecological parlance, structural complexity or structural diversity, what I increasingly call multi-generationality. So just this multi-generational forest, multi-layered canopy, trees of all different sizes and ages. They're equally defined by deadwood on the ground. You know, again, this attribute, which I think is, people look at it and they think of it as like a mess or something, but actually is an incredibly vital habitat and supports all of these important natural processes like soil building, healthy forest hydrology, things like that. You know, and we look into our forest today and we have these young, simple forests that literally have none of those attributes. And, you know, in addition, have at the same time, you know, had all these like really virulent non-native invasive plants introduced, have lost or functionally lost multiple tree species to non-native introduced pathogens, have seen themselves be fragmented by development. It's like incredible how altered our forests are. And so to then expect them to, you know, just magically heal and to just magically recapture all of these natural processes and to, you know, magically move into the future without any help when they've been fundamentally altered to this degree, I believe is unreasonable. But I also believe that we shouldn't be trying to engineer them at the same time. You know, we shouldn't be trying to define every single piece and part of what they are. What we should be doing is trying to the greatest extent that we can, help them rediscover those attributes and those qualities that, you know, they evolved for thousands of years. And in so doing, to, you know, hopefully help them be more functional and resilient as they deal with all of these other issues. But then also, like, have habitat for all of our biodiversity at a time when we know we're in a biodiversity crisis, you know, and we think there's like been a 70% decline of the number of animals on the planet in the last 50 years. And all of our songbird species are declining. And we think that there's like a million species that are threatened with extinction right now. And so when I look into our forests, I'm like, these are forests that, yes, they're, you know, in air quotes, forests, but they don't really have the tools to deal with this stuff right now. And so what I really want to do is to use the tools that we have to help them recapture some of those things.
So how are you currently doing that?
Oh, in many different ways. I mean, I think there's a couple different things. I mean, there's some simple things like where there are those non-native invasive plants that completely outcompete all of our native species and massively disrupt forests' ability to regenerate, which is also integral to their ability to be resilient and to develop that diversity and that complexity that we want to, you got to kill the invasive plants. Where there's a deer overpopulation, which is, again, like deer, white-tailed deer browse all these young trees and plants and shrubs in the understory, thus inhibiting the forest's ability to, again, regenerate, and also really degrading habitat for all of the different living things that rely on all of those different species that deer browse to death, and all of the different conditions that could be there if white-tailed deer were not there, like that multi-generationality. We kill the deer, you know, and in some places, like in Vermont, our deer, we have a deer overpopulation in most parts of the state, but it's not that high. So if we can just reform the way that we do recreational hunting and target does, you know, we could probably lower that population. In other areas, it's where deer are like more than 40 per square mile. The research suggests that recreational hunting is no longer an effective means of control on its own. So there we got to do culls, you know, and you got to hire like professional snipers to go out there and to kill all these deer. And otherwise, you know, and that's not something that any of us want to do. And yet, if you don't do that, this entire ecosystem will suffer. And by extension, all of the species that rely on it, and I include ourselves in that, will also suffer. In the case of these young, simple forests, I use forest management. On my own land, I do my own forest management. I have like a skidder, chainsaw, and I cut trees to try and create a more structurally complex multi-generational forest and to create those attributes that we know are missing from our forest and to do stuff like put dead wood on the ground. But there's a million other examples of things that we can do, but I just view all of that, you know, all that stuff, it freaks people out because these are all really scary, weird things to think about doing, killing deer and cutting trees. And yet I view them all as acts of such powerful acts of responsibility. You know, this is how we respond to this moment. And this is how we use this incredible power that we have and these incredible tools that we have and this incredible technology that we have, not to exploit ecosystems and to make them less, but to help them, you know, become what they can truly be, which is these incredibly resilient, incredibly life-filled systems.
Yeah, I love how you like reframe that as like our responsibility. It's a very interesting take on it that I don't think I've ever had a discussion about in this kind of realm, especially when it comes to biology and other things. And so it's really fascinating to hear your perspective on it. And
yeah,
what really kind of got you into this work? Was it, you know, was that the goal as you were growing up, you kind of got into this? Or like, is it just something you found in college or something you stumbled upon?
So the story, I've had to, like a superhero, I've had to like figure out what my origin story is, because in talking about How to Love a Forest with people interviewing me and doing these book events and stuff, you know, it's often a thing that people want to know. And so, and it's been kind of fun because then I get to go back and be like, oh yeah, this led to that. And that led to where I am now. So like my understanding of it, you know, in my memory was that you hear, you know, you hear about all these nature writers and biologists and people who work in ecosystems. And oftentimes they're like, I was the nature kid. You know, I was always out in the woods and I was catching frogs and I was, you know, tracking deer and I was down in the dirt looking at bugs. And that wasn't my experience at all. So I grew up in this little town called Saxton's River, which is in southeastern Vermont, Windham County. And I remember that we were, you know, the town is surrounded by forests. It's little, it's like 300 people all surrounded by these forests, but they weren't important to me at all. And I didn't feel, you know, I just wasn't that kid. That's not the childhood that I had. And I remember, like, I didn't care about the forests, but what I do remember is that I wanted to get out of there really bad. And when I was a junior in high school, I remember saying to somebody, I don't know where I'm going to go to college, but I know where I'm not going to go. And that's the University of Vermont, because everybody goes there and I'm getting out of here. And then the first semester or the first month of my senior year of high school, I got a letter from the University of Vermont that said I got this scholarship called the Green and Gold Scholarship, which is a full scholarship. And I was like, geez, well, I guess I'm going to the University of Vermont. But even when I got there, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I just kind of like bumbled around and couldn't figure out what I wanted to study. But as I was finishing up my second semester at the University of Vermont, my high school girlfriend, the first big love of my life, was coming home from this program that she had done, this expedition, 5-month wilderness expedition. And when she came back, she had had this huge, impactful, massive experience. And I had not. I'd just been like hanging out in my dorm room or whatever. And we weren't connecting. And I was 18 years old. And so I was freaking out and I thought we were going to break up. So I said, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go on a wilderness expedition. And the next one left in 2 weeks. And it was a 6-month expedition in the woods of Vermont, New Hampshire, where we'd ski north for 3 months and then build a canoe and canoe back down. And, you know, relationship didn't work out. You know, in retrospect, I did this sort of for no reason. However, it totally changed the course of my life. And after that, all I wanted to do was just be in the woods. And I worked as a wilderness guide. And I lived in this uninsulated yurt in the woods of Maine with this fir bough floor for a year. And I got to work with draft animals. I logged with draft horses for a little while. And at the end of a couple of years of that, I got another letter from the University of Vermont that said I had to come back or I was going to lose my scholarship. And so I remember sitting on the bough floor of my yurt and looking at a paper list of all the majors at the University of Vermont. And I scrolled down, I saw forestry, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew that it had the word forest in it. And so I said, I guess we'll try that. So yeah, so that's basically how it started. And I could talk to, you know, to your listeners more about forestry and career path after that. But yeah, it's just sort of this like random thing that happened to me that ended up getting me here.
Yeah, that's what's so fascinating about life is like it's just these random opportunities of you saying yes to something that totally just changes the course of your life and think you're going to do one thing and then you don't. And yeah, that's to me, it's like beauty within itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a straight line. And now when I talk to students, like tomorrow, I'm going down, talking to students at Yale, and then I'm going to talk to some students at the University of Connecticut. And I always make sure to tell them that, because I'm like, you know, you might end up on this series of random little things that you end up doing. And just because it feels that way doesn't mean that in 10 years or something, you're not going to look back and be like, oh, you know, this was a weird decision. And then this led me to this, and this led me to this, and this led me to this. And, you know, here I am, and it's exactly where I want to be.
What I think is really interesting is that expedition you went on. I'm very curious. Like, I know you said that kind of you ended up going and doing other things and then going back to Vermont, getting the forestry degree. But like during that expedition, how did being like outdoors and doing all those activities kind of change your perspective on life and like maybe influence you? Because as an outdoorsman, like I get into rock climbing, snowboarding, things like that. And I've seen those kind of sports and activities like really impact my life. So I'm kind of curious, like how maybe those have impacted yours.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually amazing. I think in some ways how, I guess resilience is the word, how resilient people are. You know, I'd like never done anything like that before. And then I just went out, and then it was like, you know, a few weeks in of just like skiing all day in the wintertime and making camp every night. And you're used to it. But I think, you know, one of the journeys that I talk about in the book is when I was doing that, I just developed such a profound relationship with ecosystems, you know, with the woods and just being out there. And I think that and some of the experiences that followed as well really made me like, a lot of these folks who are like, you know, it's just nature and it's magic, and it is magic, you know, but thinking that like, all we got to do is just kind of like get out of the way and observe. And that, you know, and that's sort of really what I felt like at that time. And then I just had to go on this whole journey to then understand how, you know, something like the cutting of trees could ever be done in a way that was positive. But that really, you know, where I still come from now at my core is that I am someone who loves forests. I'm not someone who loves forest management. I'm not someone who loves, you know, running a chainsaw just for the sake of it. Although I do love running a chainsaw now. But at my core, I'm just someone who I believe is just an advocate for ecosystems. And I want to do whatever we can do to protect these precious systems. And I want to start from a place of that deep relationship and the understanding of like the intrinsic importance of these ecosystems and how they have the right to exist and how they're something that is so precious. And then from there, build on top of that to be like, and what does that actually mean for what we do here as humans? You know, what does that mean that we're so scared of impacting, you know, these ecosystems and inserting ourselves in them that we do nothing even when they need all this help? Or is it something where we move past that and we love them so much that we're willing to do this really bittersweet and counterintuitive work, you know, even when it's hard?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, right? Especially when you say that forests are fascinating, just from the little bit of experience, like with biology class and things like that, like it is very intriguing. And obviously your knowledge goes a little bit deeper and you can see your passion for it. So what is it that, you know, someone that's not in your shoes, but like myself, like an everyday person, can maybe do to at least have some sort of impact? Because I think that's a good thing to talk about, because people want to feel useful, they want to feel purposeful, and they want to feel like they're doing something. So what do you usually recommend for people like kind of in my shoes to help out?
I mean, there's a few different things. So just broadly, what I need people to know, like a lot of times it feels like so energizing to like protest logging, you know, and to protest that kind of thing. And sometimes that's valid. Like it can definitely be done in a way that's harmful. But like here in Vermont, New Hampshire, we have these like organizations who just hate logging, and they don't care if it's, you know, they don't draw any distinction between like 120-acre clear cut in Oregon and managing for old growth characteristics and biodiversity in Vermont. It's just all log into them. And it's so like exciting and sexy to protest against that without, you know. So number one, it's like when you hear something like that, ask questions and like actually engage with like the nuance of what's trying to happen. But I wish so much that people could divert that energy and instead be advocating for and protesting against deforestation. So deforestation is the biggest threat to our forests and other ecosystems, period. Deforestation is not logging. Deforestation is the permanent conversion of forest land to some other land use. Globally, deforestation is driven, a lot of it's driven by agriculture. Here in Vermont, a lot of it's like residential and commercial development. And we're losing tens of thousands of acres of forest land a year, even in this tiny little state. So, you know, that those are forests that will never regrow, that will never provide habitat for biodiversity, that will never sequester and store carbon ever again. They can't do anything ever again. And a lot of times what's being protested is like really responsible forest management on public lands in areas that are already protected, you know, and where people are managing for this like really cool stuff, and that will be forest forever. And as they're doing that, you know, under their noses, we're losing tens of thousands of acres of forest land forever. And so I think that it's a lot less sexy to think about like advocating for land use reform. But in general, that's where I want people to focus. And in doing that, I think it's the most, one of the most things that powerful things that we can do is to be advocates for conservation. So supporting your local land trusts, supporting the protection of land through permanent conservation easements as much as we possibly can. Now, those are easements that they don't say no management in most cases. They're just protected from subdivision and development forever. So like get in touch with your local land trust and ask them what you can do. And then the other thing I would say is that the local issues that what you can do, whoever you are and wherever you are really nuanced. But, you know, and this is from being a part of a conservation community here in Vermont and the Northeast. I know that there are conservation organizations near you. You know, maybe it's your local Audubon chapter. Maybe it's your local Woodland Owners Association. Maybe it's your local land trust. Maybe it's something else. And they're trying to reach you right now. Like it's, as a part of a conservation community, we'd always be like coming up with these resources and these educational events and just trying to reach out to people, having such a hard time just like getting people engaged. And those are the people, that conservation community are the people who can tell you exactly what you can do in your area in a nuanced way. You know, I can't tell you what exactly you should do in North Carolina in a very specific way because I'm just up here in Vermont and things are different up here. But I would say figure out who those organizations are in your area and reach out to them and ask them.
It's kind of like a lot of education and then reaching out and asking questions to the right individuals.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, I think, and those people will be so overjoyed to hear from you. Because again, like, you would not believe the amount of resources available to you that are out there right now. And, you know, those people are just like, how do we get these into the hands of people?
So what was kind of the deciding factor to write the book?
Well, so it was this whole process. It took, to write the book itself really took 6 years. But the whole process took 8 years. And so I basically like, I was just realizing, just like I was talking about, that I'm like, man, oh man, these forests need so much help. And I feel like when we actually try to use the tools at our disposal, like cutting trees, to help them, they're so consistently misunderstood. And these people who love forests and care about them are giving us such a hard time and calling us names and making life so difficult when what we're really trying to do is, you know, take action to appeal to these values that we share, you know, which is that we love forests and what, you know, and maybe just have a little bit more of an in-depth understanding of like what that actually means in action. And so I was like noticing that. And then the other catalyzing event was becoming the owner of this piece of land, which I call Bear Island, here in northwestern Vermont. And it was just like the most degraded forest that I'd ever been to. And it was just such a good example of a forest that needed my action, you know, and that a forest that inaction would have been an act of negligence. One thing I say in the book is like, I believe that we can degrade forests by exploiting them. And I believe that we can degrade forests by doing nothing. And, you know, and not utilizing this tremendous power and this tremendous potential at our disposal to deal with these incredibly serious issues. So I was, you know, I was working as a forester and noticing these sort of disconnects, and then working on this land, Bear Island, which helped me catalyze so many of these ideas. And I just decided I wanted to write. I wanted to start writing. And so I started writing. I figured out that the time when my brain is the most productive and creative is the first hour that I'm awake in the morning, 5 to 6 a.m. And so I just developed this practice where every day I would get up and I would drink my coffee and I would write for an hour. And, you know, if I at that time had been like, I'm writing a book, I think it would have been too intimidating and I never would have even started. But I could write for an hour, you know? And so I just wrote for an hour for 6 years. And I think it was like year three that I allowed myself to accept that I was trying to write a book, you know? But yeah, then it developed and it became, you know, then the first drafts were just like, oh, this is what forests are and this is how we should take care of them. And it was like really dry and didactic. And then in the later years, I really inserted, it made it so much more personal and so much more universal and so much more narrative based, because my hope was that this can be a book that appeals to people no matter where they are. And, you know, that sort of speaks to our relationship with ecosystems more broadly. And then, so I wrote it 6 years, signed with the publisher, and I was like, well, this thing's going to be out in a couple of weeks. No problem. And then they were like, well, your publication date is in 2 years. And so then finally, September 10, 2024, it actually came out. And now I've just gotten to share it with so many people.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how writing can shape a lot of things, like honestly shape the world if you think about it, right? Because you went from writing an hour every day and it's just like your thoughts, feelings, things that you know that you're just getting out. And then once it, you apply some structure to it, it just becomes something that can really impact society as a whole.
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's powerful stuff and it's been so gratifying just to hear from all these other people, you know, the thousands and thousands of people that have now bought the book, that these are ideas that resonate with them. Is, you know, it would have been cool enough just to be able to write a book, you know, and then cool enough just to get it published, but then to have those things and then have it be something that people feel like they connect with and that's important is just like wild.
Yeah, I think it has to do with a lot of the meaning and passion behind it because it's coming from you, you know, that's the big takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of moving into like, you know, you wrote a book, but something I wanted to circle back to is like the content creation. And I'm kind of curious because I'm slowly getting into the physical therapy profession and we're seeing the rise of obviously YouTube, social media, all these things. And it's like becoming it can be like a great educational source.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you kind of got out of the content creation. So I'm kind of curious because like our professors are kind of telling us to maybe start pushing social media, posting things, getting information out there to like make an impact. Do you think that's kind of the same logic that like foresters and like other, like it doesn't have to be foresters, but people that are working in like the environmental front and other front should be doing things like that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's so funny, like, my whole career, well, not my whole career, but a lot of my career, I've been like a bit of a unicorn in the forestry world, because so many, you know, in forestry, a lot of folks who are in forestry, they got into it because they wanted to like hang out by themselves in the woods all the time. And they didn't want to, you know, be talking to people all day. And I actually found out, not through any like training or anything I knew about myself, but I was just like, we got to talk about this stuff. And then I found out that I actually find it to be super energizing and I really like it. But it's been wild. Like, I started this account earlier, like the beginning of this year. And I started it because I was like, well, I'm just going to, you know, this will be a way for me to publicize the book. And then I started making content and stuff. And now, you know, it's November 11th, 2024, almost a year later. I got, you know, 27,000 followers on there and another 10,000 or so across a few other platforms. So I have 27,000 on Instagram, and then the other ones are YouTube, TikTok, Facebook. And, you know, that's a tremendous, you know, way to share some pretty powerful ideas with people and to reach out to a lot of people directly. And it's sort of become its own thing. But, you know, to you and other folks who are maybe thinking about it, the most powerful thing that I did that allowed me to do this work was that I didn't do any content creation, and I barely engaged with social media at all. And what I did was mentally recategorize social media from something that I did or didn't do for myself to work. So I was like, this is my job now. And that allowed me to get over all the cringiness and the ostentatiousness and the whole, all that stuff, and to just like put it out there. And to, you know, I think that it's been really gratifying to see that you do that. And if you keep plugging and make content that's engaging and keep learning and making better content. Like, I look back at my stuff that I made earlier this year and it looks so primitive and bad versus right now. And, you know, just keep on changing and keep on trying to get better at it. And I really do think it's a powerful tool. And I have, there's a bunch of different reasons that I think it's powerful way to get it out. But I think in the conservation community, I think it also allows us to reach different people who are consuming information this way that we just straight up weren't reaching before. And one of the things that I think about is when I'm, you know, at these meetings of Vermont Woodlands Association, or, you know, at these walks that I lead with the Vermont Land Trust or Audubon Vermont, or, you know, the Vermont Department of Forest, Parks and Recreation, or the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife, you know, there are awesome people at those walks, and sometimes they can be very well attended, but I always feel like the median age is like 65. And on my Instagram channel, the median age is like 35. And so that to me alone is such a profound statement of that this is something that has the power to like engage and hopefully mobilize more people. And then also, yeah, it's like, you know, the book has been doing really well, and I've been on this 70-date book tour over like 3 months, and all of that is from Instagram. Truly, you know, some of those are connections I already had, but none of that would have happened. Like, those dates were pretty much all booked from people who heard about me from Instagram. All of those sales, or the vast majority of them, are people who heard about me on Instagram. And so it's for real. I mean, it's a real tool. And then it's not just a means to an end for me. It's not anymore. Or it's not like this is just a way that I publicize the book. I'm like, this is also its own thing. This is also another way that I get to reach out to people. And and I think it's really powerful. I think people should be, even if it makes them uncomfortable, I think that people should push through that and recognize that.
Yeah, I love how you said it was like the perspective switch, right? And I think that's something that I had to take kind of going into this, and like what I'm going to take into the future information, educational stuff that I plan to push out. And so, yeah, I would kind of say that because I can understand like the hesitancy to not want to do it, because whether it's being in front of a camera, but like what's great is there are other ways, right? Like, you know, Instagram, TikTok are definitely reels and video, but then you have Twitter that is literally, you can just write and can go so far. But I think that's the thing. But it's like you said, you're hitting that one population of in-person coming to walk that are 65-year-olds, and then you're hitting the 35-year-olds. And then on TikTok, you're probably even getting the younger people. And then all of a sudden, if you have all these different personalities doing something else, you can inspire the next generation, which is more beneficial than probably what we're doing right now. I'm not saying that what you're not doing isn't great, but it's like we have to have people take up the torch after we go, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, for folks who are thinking about doing it, I think one of the big barriers is it just like seems intimidating. And people are afraid of doing it and doing a bad job or something. And let me just be the one to tell you that you doing it and doing a bad job is better than you doing nothing. Like that is, you know, people think that if you went out there and you made like videos and you know, you didn't think they were that good or whatever, that would be in some ways worse. And it's not. What you're doing now, if you're doing nothing, what you're doing now is worse. So like, just do it and just keep on trying. And you don't have to be like a, you know, 19-year-old. You can just go out there and make stuff and do your best, and you'll have an impact.
Ethan, man, well said. I appreciate everything you've talked to us and educated us about this entire episode. Like, thank you again for coming on and just kind of moving forward. People can follow you on, sounds like, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, and then
as well as your book.
Yeah. Yeah. You can order How to Love a Forest anywhere books are sold. And it's a hardcover and an ebook and an audiobook as well. And yeah, follow me on all those platforms at under the handle at How to Love a Forest. And you can check out more about me at ethantapper.com.